My body is not your battleground. My hair is neither sacred nor cheap, neither the cause of your disarray, nor the path to your liberation. My hair will not bring progress and clean water. If it flies unbraided in the breeze, it will not save us from our attackers if it is wrapped and shielded from the sun. Untangle your hands from my hair so I can comb and delight in it, so I can honor and anoint it, so I can spill it over the chest of my sweet love.
This was an excerpt from Moja Kaf's 1998 poem, My Body is Not Your Battleground, and a great opening to our first New Year's episode of Lady Fiction, a podcast dedicated to women's writing at the Amerika-Zentrum Hamburg's Transatlanticist series. I'm your host, Stephanie Schäfer, and I'm happy to start the new year with some fresh energy to discuss one of the conflicts that has been on my mind a lot since it began last year. The protests in Iran, triggered by the torture and murder of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini by police. Since September, we've had news from protests and revolts against the suppression of women in Iran, with the slogan, Women, Life, Freedom. When Iranian women expressed their protests by discarding their headscarves and cutting their long hair, this led to a wave of international solidarity with such phenomena as social media videos of women celebrities and politicians cutting off their tresses to note their solidarity, which I found very strange. In the political arena, we've seen marches and demonstrations in support of the Iranian protest movement around the world. And with the capital punishment of young protesters seen through by the Mullah regime, the EU and the US have responded by imposing sanctions on Iran and reinvigorating an old conflict that is a dangerous one. Last November, the New York Times wrote, "The United States enters a new era of direct confrontation with Iran." In Germany specifically, the protests raised questions regarding the approach to foreign policy by our new foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock. Just a few days before Amini's murder sparked the protest, Baerbock gave a speech on her approach to a feminist foreign policy, a concept rooted in the struggle for gender equality pertaining to rights, resources, and representation, and to diversity. So here are a few questions I've been asking myself since. How does this feminist foreign policy approach go together with the careful weighing of sanctions and the diplomatic dealings with the Iranian regime we've seen? What does a feminist foreign policy mean, and how do Western nations transport their own understandings of feminism alongside their economic interests to other spheres of interest and to other countries? And how would artistic responses to this conundrum deal with this? So all these are my questions, and I will direct them at my guest today, whom you already heard in the opening, Dr. Katharina Motul, who hopefully has answers. Hi, Katharina.
Hi, Stephanie.
No pressure here, right?
So, some small questions.
Some small questions. So before we start talking, I want to introduce you so our listeners will see why you're such a great commentator on this topic of imperial feminism and Arab-American responses. Katharina Motul is assistant professor at the American Studies Department of the University of Mannheim. Her second book project is titled Dependent in the Land of Liberty, Drugs, Addiction, and Power in U.S. Culture from the Early Republic to the War on Drugs. Her publications include the edited volumes Who Can Speak and Who Is Heard Hurt, Facing Problems of Race, Racism, and Ethnic Diversity in the Humanities in Germany, and The Failed Individual Amid Exclusion, Resistance, and the Pleasure of Nonconformity, published with Campus in 2017. Her articles have appeared in the Studies of American Naturalism and Interconnections, Journal of Posthumanism, and her PhD thesis at the FU Berlin examined Arab-American literature since 9/11 and the literary production of Arab and or Muslim women in the US, as well as Arab and Muslim feminisms. It's under contract with Campus Publishers. Dr. Motul also investigates the nexus between digital anti-feminism and other feminisms, and these all make her a perfect conversation partner for today. So, Katharina, here's my question. Isn't it great that so many pretty white ladies cut off some hair to declare their feminist support of the Iran protests? What do you think?
I'm a little ambivalent about it because obviously the protests were sparked in Iran. Iranian women have been incredibly brave, you know, taking off the headscarf, which in the Islamic Republic is mandatory to wear. So as has been documented, the regime has not exactly been, soft on these women. And then sort of this idea of cutting off hair, this came about in the social media and, you know, white Western celebrities taking up the issue. So it's been helpful because, you know, these actresses enjoy all types of capital. And if they on Instagram raise awareness for this very important political issue in Iran, that's of course to be lauded. I think we just need to be careful to still seek out what Iranian women in Iran want, right? Or at least, you know, then listen, you know, to, let's say, Iranian women or their allies in the West who can translate from Farsi. So I think probably the ideal approach would be, oh, you know, someone is made aware, like, let's say, in Germany or the US by, you know, Claire Danes' video posted on Twitter and Instagram. But then hopefully they'll, you know, get interested in the issue and branch out and to actually, you know, seek out some Iranian women's voices.
Yes. And I mean, one of the key points about this has been that the regime has also started banning access to social media platforms. So social media has become, quote unquote, a little bit of a battleground in this conflict as well. Access to the social media platforms and to that kind of self-expression. But also protesters have been tracked down through their social media profile and they have been prosecuted and executed.
Yes.
So this is a really, it's such a timely conflict, if that's not so such a, you know, cynical thing to say, but it's really difficult to entangle all the strands of protests and all the meanings of this. And while it's clear that, you know, the repression of women has to end, I also think in some of the utterances of Western feminists, there's a certain kind of, you know, lack of knowledge or maybe disregard for what the struggle really may be. And so I'm so happy to have you today and to talk with you about this double standard, because in your article, Saving Maria, Mitsu and Masha, U.S. Imperial Feminism from the Mexican-American War to the War on Terror, you identify the concept of imperial feminism, and you discuss it and say that basically the U.S. has always pursued its imperial power interests, even when it claimed it was saving women from, you know, evil paternalistic men. So let's talk about this imperial feminism thing a bit.
Definitely, I'd love to. This work on how Western empires have justified their imperial presences in Muslim majority countries was this important research was carried on by Leila Ahmed, and so she originally coined the term colonial feminism. And so basically the British were the first in, you know, mid-19th century when they established imperial rule in Egypt. Lord Cromer, who de facto was the president, the governor of British Empire in Egypt. He published this massively influential volume, Modern Egypt, and here argued, of course, in this by now quite familiar binary of East versus West, where, you know, the East, so Islam and countries culturally influenced by Islam, were cast as backwards, unrational, versus the West, which was cast as rational, enlightened, these things. And Lord Cromer argued that Egyptian backwardness, of course, in scare quotes, manifested in the degradation of women, which Lord Cromer argued was inherent to Islam. And he argued that the practices of gender segregation, and particularly the practice of veiling, showed, exemplified the oppression of women that was, according to Cromer, inherent to Islam. If the East, so again, this shorthand for Muslim-majority countries, were to advance on the path towards civilization, the practice of veiling needed to end. In this article, which you mentioned, I then argue that in the war on terror, the global war on terror, the George W. Bush administration waged on Afghanistan, and then later Iraq, the George W. Bush administration and the U.S. basically took up this legacy of Western imperial feminism in the greater Middle East. And then later, I sort of broadened this investigation and actually found out that even in earlier imperial endeavors, for example, the Mexican-American War in the 1840s, and then also in the occupation of Japan following World War II, the U.S. actually justified its imperial presence by pointing to the plight of local women, which the U.S. wanted to improve.
And that became the reason for invading, taking over. And in your article, you write it's a gesture of white men protecting brown women from brown men.
Yeah, this is the Spivak term. So Spivak this, of course, you know, her research is on India, and she calls this white men saving brown women from brown men. Yeah.
These are places of conflict where the empire, in this case the U.S., arrived, and they had geopolitical interests, and then they needed a crutch to stand on, a rhetorical crutch, and one of these crutches became the liberation of veiled women, thus making appropriating Arab and Muslim women into the discourse of, you know, imperial fantasy, and of course replaying Orientalist tropes of, and you get this specifically with the war, Mexican War in the 1840s, the senoritas who are only longing for a white savior. Mm-hmm. So there's a lots of affective dimensions in this as well, as poor victims looking for liberation, you know, the good empire, the Americanizedness all played out. This is a term that Kerry Tirado Brahman has written about. So, Katharina, how is imperial feminism challenged by Muslim or Arab feminism? What do feminists of color have to say in response to the project of imperial feminism?
So this is a very important question, because what we were just talking about, basically, that the U.S. and us other Western countries have cloaked their imperial ambitions in feminist rhetoric. This is not to deny that in, you know, Afghanistan in the late 90s and turn of the 21st century, there were real women's rights violations. as we're coming back to today's context, it's of course a problem that the Islamic Republic of Iran mandates that women have to veil when they leave the house, right? The aspect of choice is missing. And I know through personal experience, because my partner is originally from Iran, that actually first graders already have to veil. So my husband's niece in Tehran, when she started school at 6 years old, she had to veil. And this is mandatory. But the point, of course, is that imperial feminism takes away agency from local women, be it Afghani or Iranian, who are actually organizing around these issues. So as Lila Abu-Lukhod, an American anthropologist of Arab descent, has argued in her seminal work, Do Muslim Women Really Need Saving? So even in this extremely repressive Taliban regime in the late 90s, there were Afghan women who were, you know, trying to organize against the Taliban's prohibition that girls and women receive an education, for example. It's just that the issues they were centering was not so much clothing, right? Whereas like in the West at the time, it was all about the burqa. Ooh, the Taliban mandate that women have to wear the burqa. And again, the point is, of course, that if it's not a choice, it's repressive. But it's very interesting to see that Afghan feminists were centering on education, right? Whereas in the West, this obsession with the veil that has been there since really the beginning then of Orientalism, and particularly, as I mentioned before, since the British established imperialism in Egypt, it's just this obsession with modes of clothing, whereas, you know, as Arab and Muslim feminists will argue, what really makes a difference in women's lives is not so much clothing, but access to education, healthcare, protection from sexualized violence, or ways of redress when sexualized violence has been visited upon women. Okay. But so bridging into the actual poem and Moja Kaf, the problem is that, or that Arab and Muslim feminists in the greater Middle East, but also then in the Western diasporas face, is that this long tradition of Western imperialist feminism has tainted the feminist struggles. So that feminists in Egypt, but also, let's say, Arab American feminists frequently are criticized for allegedly continuing the usurpation of their communities that imperialism started. And so
I have an example. This just came to me. So this is the second Sex and the City film. So Sex and the City is the series of the 90s about four young women in their 30s dating in New York. And then they get to travel and they go to the Middle East because they need to get away, get some sun, and, you know. And they're in a room with Arab women. And of course, there's a huge divide between those, you know, also liberal white women who, you know, wear their Malono Blahniks and pertain to Western beauty standards and the short skirts and the, you know, normative images of beauty. And then all of a sudden, these Arab women start taking down their veils, and ta-da, who would have thunk it? Underneath, they're wearing designer clothes. And then there's a huge scene of, you know, international feminist reunion where they all, you know, confess to being in love with I don't know, Gucci and Versace. And I'm like, I mean, this is almost 20 years ago, I think, that the film came out. But I thought it was such a arrogant gesture because it, you know, in this chick lit manner and this, you know, post-feminist backlash, it totally, totally undid anything that, you know, Arab feminists were struggling for and reduced it to, oh, you get the money. You can wear the bright colors underneath the burqa. You can still be free in your veil.
Yeah, yeah.
It was such a paternalistic, imperialist gesture. I thought it was terrible. But that's Sex and the City 20 years ago.
I couldn't agree. I couldn't agree more. It was, as you outlined, extremely problematic because freedom was equated with the freedom to consume. And I think the subtext was, if I remember this terrible film correctly, it was designer lingerie. So yeah, there might even have been this narrative, oh, there is polygamy in the Arab world, in the generic Arab world. And of course, these women then have to compete for, they might be the second or third wife, and they have to compete for the attention of the husband. So, you know, who can wear the sexiest lingerie. Yes, wow. So this is certainly how not to do it.
So let's talk about a response that you outlined, or that you quoted from in the opening, Moja Kaf's, that My Body Is Not Your Battleground, a poem.
So in a nutshell, this poem from, as you pointed out, the late 90s actually still is extremely current. So it's a powerful indictment of the instrumentalization of Muslim women's bodies in the male-dominated traditionalism versus modernization debate within the Islamic world. And at the same time, the poem is a powerful celebration of women's corporeality and women's sexual self-determination.
Can you talk about corporeality? What do you mean?
So we repeatedly find, just like in the stanza which I read out, the speaker's appeal to a you, and this you, again, I read as the Muslim establishment, which comes in two shades. I'll go into this later. So this appeal to this you to untangle your hands from my hair. Leave me to discover the lakes that glisten in my green forests. Who has given you permission to put your hand there? So basically, it, the whole poem, which I would say comes close to like a Muslim feminist manifesto in short form, perhaps. So it argues against cassecting, so loading Muslim women's bodies with symbolic meaning, and instead arguing for a celebration of Muslim women's bodies in its materiality, right? So basically, leave me to discover the lakes that glisten in my green forests and to understand the power of their waters. So, of course, your waters, I don't know if I have to spill it out, but of course, a you know, metaphor alluding to some of the physiological responses women's bodies have when sexually aroused. So it's definitely a controversial poem, not only in terms of the subject matter, you know, it's such a heads-on, a self-assertive and heads-on confrontation of the male Muslim establishment, but, you know, also performatively by a Syrian American woman who was at the time of that the poem was written. She was just, you know, in her early 30s. So, of course, here performatively, Moja Kaf challenges stereotypes Western hegemonic discourses may have about Muslim women, right? She very much writes about things that are considered taboo, even by Western standards. I mean, you know, women's sexual self-determination and masturbation. And I don't think you find that in the New York Times too often. Perhaps now, but not in the late 90s.
And you know, what I find is interesting is that it's not, when we talk about this, who's the I and who's the you? So my body is not your battleground. Mm. Obviously, the lyrical I is going to be a reflection of Moja Kaf, the author. Mm-hmm. But the you and what she wants to do with her body are not so, they're not, you know, spelled out. So this is, on the one hand, obviously speaking back to Muslim men, but it might also be speaking back to American imperialism, which I find is so interesting. So it starts with the body parts that needs to should be released. Mm-hmm. So in the first stanza, the body part that needs to be freed from paternalism is the breasts, the marker of female identity, whether it be a biological one or a non-biological marker of gender. So it says, my breasts seek amnesty, release them so I can glory in their milk-tipped fullness, so I can offer them to my sweet love. And the sweet love here can be the child for breastfeeding, mm-hmm. but it can also be a lover, mm-hmm. a lover who remains uncertified. It could also be, you know, a female lover. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting that opposite this you who is attacking the speaker and who has hijacked her body is a lover, somebody who the speaker is tuned to, who might be a child, who might be another partner, who might be a sexual, you know, a woman sexual partner. And it's really in this indeterminacy that the privacy also lies of this. Mm-hmm. It's not declared and it shouldn't be declared. Mm-hmm. So it's really a response. I think it seems to me with this indeterminacy, it seems the you can be both a man, both the Arab establishment, or the international imperial project telling Arab and Muslim women how to feel and how to be, specifically with the hair. That's where I got the we talk a lot about hair here, specifically with the hair. My hair is neither sacred nor cheap. My hair will not bring progress and clean water if it flies unbraided in the breeze. Mm-hmm. So all the, you know, Claire Danes and the celebrities cutting off their hair, it really, you know, it doesn't do anything other than making a nice photo op on social media. That was my critical response. So I liked the stanza, untangle your hands from my hair so I can comb and delight in it.
Yeah.
You know, keep your hair off my hair, I guess. That's the short hair woman. Maybe I have short hair and I've always had short hair. So I'm attuned to hair topics a lot. Okay.
So. Sure. I thought you gave an excellent reading. So this ambivalence, I think this is very much central also to the poem's aesthetic and political agenda. I think there are, let's say, a few hints that, you know, suggest reading you know, the you in a certain way, or perhaps the speaker's situation. But then there's always these moments where, as you pointed out, ambiguous readings are invited. So I, for example, would make a case that, you know, the milk-tipped fullness, and then is it your skin that will tear when the head of the new world emerges? The speaker is probably writing from the perspective of a pregnant woman. And, you know, this child that comes out into the world may be a girl. So this is one of the ways you can read it. What kind of world do I want for my daughter, or also, you know, for my son, you know, and that particularly, as we have made clear in this conversation so far, that gender plays such an important role in, yeah, with regard to hegemonic discourses on Arabs and Muslims, right? So in Hollywood, you know, that this is extremely polarized stereotypes about Arab women, either the hypersexual seductress or
Jezebel,
the, you know, veiled, reed, oppressed woman. And I would argue, along with Evelyn Aswatani, an Arab American media studies scholar, that actually, in fact, both of these stereotypes, which at first glance seem quite diametrically opposed, if you read them in terms of a metonymy or an allegory, so, you know, woman standing in symbolically meaning country, right? I mean, this, you know, you're an expert on figurations of the national. I mean, right, this was so central, like in the 19th century. So like, whatever, Lady Liberty then standing for the US as a whole. And so, you know, if we're standing with the hypersexual seductress, you know, doing this come hither gesture to an American male viewer, of course, this in a way invites, hey, come hither, US intervention. And of course, then, you know, the veiled meaning oppress woman is also inviting U.S. intervention in the sense of, oh, you know, let's bring, you know, light to this oppressed part of the world, something like this. And the reason, and I think you're completely right to argue that per se, the U can be read as, you know, the Muslim establishment or actually Western U.S. Or Western or U.S. imperial feminism, or even, you know, Western feminists who don't take seriously Arab and Muslim feminists. I would make a case that with this part, has God then given you permission to put your hand there? There again being the private parts, I mean, it was private areas, I think before the, that sort of the text implicitly makes a case that the U it addresses is the male Muslim establishment, which, as I mentioned before, comes in two iterations, if you will. It's interesting to see that, you know, once British imperialism had established itself in Egypt with this thesis that, you know, Egypt, what Egypt was lacking was civilization. And this was particularly visible when one looked at the way that Egyptians treated women, this trope of the allegedly inherent misogyny of Islam. Egyptian middle class and upper class intellectual men were internalizing this discourse, right? And were then arguing, oh, this is true. And you actually, and this was again, not just the case in Egypt, but sort of in greater Middle East and some other countries. So for example, in the early 20th century, you had the Mohammad Reza Shah in Iran arguing that veiling needed to stop, that this was uncivilized. And you had Atatürk in Turkey arguing that, you know, we're someone. We as Turkey are modern, and this practice of veiling is just backward. So this was basically the hegemonic discourse in many Middle Eastern countries, and Nasser too, right? Gamal Abdel Nasser in the 1950s was arguing against veiling. And then really through this Islamist resurgence, did this idea come about that in Muslim majority societies that actually these societies needed to go back to their own culture and, you know, needed to rediscover Islam and with it, the practice of veiling. And this was, of course, that the fact that this Islamist resurgence has been quite powerful. This, of course, has had much to do with the disappointment that many in Middle Eastern countries were feeling regarding Westernization and U.S. interventionism.
So I'm going to resume with the question here of the Imperial Feminist Project and how to speak back. It's a post-colonial or decolonization effort on the one hand, of course, But it's also an effort of using different channels. And it's so interesting to see, you said earlier, this might be a manifesto, which would ask us questions about how to, what is our understanding of a manifesto for a social movement, right? The, you know, the surrealists and all the avant-garde made very sure that we know what a manifesto is supposed to look like. So if this is a corporeality self-assertion manifesto, it's also intriguing that it's collected in a story collection or poem collection that's called Emails from his Scheherazade, the Orientalist storyteller who tells story to, you know, keep at bay her execution in the Tales of 1001 Nights. So it's really, it's wrapped up in that bind. You can't get, I mean, you can highlight the Orientalist paradigm, but you can't go outside of it, it yes. seems. There's no returning or pulling back completely. It's
a big problem. So let's just say, I mean, this is also, you know, among Arab American writers, some are saying, guys, we really need to stop making intertextual references to Scheherazade or stuffed grape leaves, because basically we're just perpetuating stereotypes. But particularly, I think your observation is spot on, particularly to this question of how does the Arab American community or Muslims generally respond to Orientalism and its extremely gendered stereotypes. So again, I've already talked about the
The obsession with the veil.
With the veil, or, you know, the woman as, you know, either oppressed or hypersexualized. And then, of course, Arab masculinities being represented as, you know, the misogynist, potentially violent, you know, having a temper.
We have seen a lot of that recently in Germany, I have to say. And German politics is capitalizing on that. It's become a hot button issue. So
yeah, you mean with the... Like with the
with the pashas and the events.
With the pashas and I guess New Year's Eve. The idea that migrant young men were attacking police and rescue workers. Yeah, certainly. And it's interesting, to see how has the community responded. So let's say that these, so just in a nutshell, right, we can, basically these discourses have really been proliferating since the 1960s. So it's not that, you know, in earlier times there weren't these stereotypes, but basically they've just calcified since the 1960s. And then Arab American ethnographers and sociologists such as Nadine Naber have been arguing that the way that Arabs in the US were responding was to just basically reverse this binary thinking. So whereas you in hegemonic discourses that we were talking about, you had the binary, and then basically they were just flipping it around and arguing that, you know, virginity was very important, and whereas, you know, the West is sexually corrupt and young whatever white American girls are dressing inappropriately, our own daughters, so Arab daughters, are, you know, respectful and appropriate and dressing appropriately, and that, you know, virginity before marriage is valued. And this seemed to be quite predominant for a while. And I would then say that pretty much since the early 21st century, when suddenly Arab and Muslim Americans were really in the limelight of the media. And of course, you know, this whole early war on terror discourse, Arabs and Muslims being suspected of being terrorists, having to justify themselves, basically this spotlight, whereas one would have thought, oh, the idea is we're already under threat, so let's not air dirty laundry. That this was also actually used as an opportunity to say, no, let's actually, you know, defy some harmful Western stereotypes, but let's perhaps also rethink the cultural politics that's hegemonic in our communities. and to actually, and yeah, really Arab American, Muslim American feminists and their allies have been invested in that work, namely to deconstruct these binaries as such. And also, you know, saying, well, you know, there is some misogyny in our communities. Queer and trans members of our communities have had a particularly hard time, perhaps, and to basically bring that all out in the open and have a discussion about it.
Yeah. And that's the one point that where I had an issue with Mojakov's text,
yeah.
Because it seems to me at the end it's quite essentialist. It's basically also a pacifist text, an anti-war text, and the ending basically makes this point, and it says, withdraw from the Eastern Front and the West. Withdraw these armaments and this siege so that I may prepare the earth for the new age of lilac and clover, so that I may celebrate this spring the pageant of beauty with my sweet love. So it reiterates, on the one hand, it says, you know, domination is war and it needs to end, and I can totally hear that, but it recedes to a essentialist trope of the woman nurturer, so that I can prepare the earth for the new age of lilac and clover, the new woman cultivator. I may celebrate this spring the pageant of beauty with my sweet love. You know, it doesn't leave a lot of space for non-binary readings or queer readings. It's feminist in a binary kind of sense, and I wonder, when we talk about this, coming back to what I opened with, all the big questions asked in the opening about feminist foreign policy. So art has reservoirs for responding to this and performing otherness. But what Baerbock talked about in her speech just a few days before Mahsa Amini was murdered was the adaptation of a feminist foreign policy based on the three R's. That would be rights, resources, so education, and representation. Mm. And she added diversity to this. Mm. And of course, then after Iran happened and the protests were increasing, lots of conservative commentators came back and asked Baerbock, so what's going on with your feminist foreign policy? It's all, you know, it's all just words and no do. Since we've seen Baerbock talk to the Iranian ambassador, we've seen her broker sanctions on the Iranian regime with the Europeans. So I do think at the end of the day, there is such a thing that's a feminist foreign policy, but it needs to include diversity, and it can't be limited to a, what I would call maybe, you know, adapting your term that you so usefully define, it can't be an imperial feminist project. We're saying we are more civilized than you, so you need to, you know, have your women walk freely in the roads and you know, abandon the veil, and you know, it needs to veer away from that obsession with veiling and unveiling. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, what was at work when all the wonderful, beautiful white women started cutting their hair off, because they saw this as the ultimate act of liberation that they wanted to parrot and maybe speak back and use to express their solidarity. But investments in education, in political representation are much more important. So this week, we've also had news from Afghanistan, which you also talked about, and which nobody cared about the women of Afghanistan when the Americans got out and the Europeans hastened to get out too. This was last summer. It's a catastrophe, really, right? No one cared about Afghanistan's women. And now... Now this week, I was heartened at the same time as I was still, you know, surprised that we get so little media coverage. But I was heartened to hear that the Taliban now allowed women to go back with NGO work, to be workers in NGO organizations, because the women of Afghanistan are still fighting by themselves, and it's not so much about the veil; it's basically about the three R's: resources, rights, and representation. So it's really not about the body panic around dress. It's really about the bigger issues. And I think that's where we have to be careful not to re-import the imperial feminist project here. And I'm also interested, maybe there's not much time, we can talk about it another time, but there are new books about feminism coming out. that are attacking, or at least they're critical of white feminism. I'm thinking of Rafia Zakaria's Against White Feminism, published in 2021. And I'm particularly interested in Kayla Scholler's The Trouble with White Women, A Counter History of Feminism, which puts case studies of feminist positions one against each other. So a white feminist position against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the US. So these are recent books. And I wonder if they also have something about hair, because this is my personal hair episode. But I'm interested to keep up this conversation.
Yeah. And I mean, perhaps I haven't touched upon this yet, but it was not just that George W. Bush and his administration were arguing that intervening in Afghanistan would bring very oppressed women rights. I mean, of course, first ladies were involved. Also, speeches by Laura Bush and Tony Blair, the UK being the US's closest ally in the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. It was actually the Feminist Majority Foundation. This is a mainstream feminist organization testifying in Congress in the fall of 2001, that, you know, basically supporting an invasion, arguing that women in Afghanistan were so oppressed and basically needed, you know, help, so that interventionism was justified. Whereas it's no secret that those individuals most affected by wars are usually women. Right. Mm. So, I mean, what kind of freedom does bombing bring? It's this is, of course, now also in the moment in which we're talking, I want to make clear that I don't think pacifism is justified in each and every case. I mean, we're just, you know, facing Putin's war of aggression, or even settler imperialist aggression against Ukraine. But of course, we have to be very specific. And I think responding to this unprecedented terror attack of September 11th, there could have been other ways of responding. I mean, first of all, one could have treated this as, you know, a criminal justice case, you know, and so on. I mean, I don't have a PhD in political science, but sort of there were several options. And then basically to argue, well, you know, Osama bin Laden sponsored these terrorists. Let's now go for Afghanistan, where Osama bin Laden is located. That was a very particular response. And again, some mainstream feminists really, I'm sorry if this sounds very emotionalized, but I mean, really, like the Feminist Majority Foundation, in a way, has blood on its hands, because it really testified before Congress that, you know, this U.S. intervention was justified. And so there are, I'm so glad you're bringing up these recent books that, yeah, discuss power asymmetries within feminism. But even I think in the early 2000s, this book, This Bridge We Call Home, and this gathered women's of colors voices who were, amongst other things, talking about their ostracization in feminist circles, or their not being taken seriously by white feminists. So I guess it almost sounds like a mainstay to you and I, but like this important idea of intersectionality and being mindful of one's own situatedness and being mindful of the tradition of the discourse in which one is speaking is, yeah, extremely important.
Yeah. So this podcast started with so many questions. I know that some of them are answered. Some of them, it's quite obvious we need to keep up the conversation and be mindful of this imperial feminist discourse that often comes to pass as a kind of supremacy in heels, which is a headline from Harper's Bazaar, which I find a nice metaphor for this, because it also replicates this beauty standard and consumption thing, consumerism thing. So we will certainly keep an eye out on the discourses and, of course, on the struggles of the women in Iran, and remember the struggles of women elsewhere. I have learned today not to focus so much on the veil, but focus on other things as well. And I'd like to thank you, Katharina, for being my guest and sparring partner in this.
Thank you, Stephanie, for giving me the opportunity to discuss these important matters with you.
Thank you. So to all our listeners out there, I hope you enjoyed today's session, and please tune in again soon. Bye-bye.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the AmericaZentrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.